before we cut our cords, and streaming was years away. You could only binge on old DVDs, and seasons didn't last one day. But how did we cope? The weekly wait was such a tease. With the 2-hour block of shows, we could endure with ease. On every Thursday, could tune into NBC. Travel to Dundee, Mifflin, Greendale, TGS, San Pawnee. They stopped calling him a sea, but it was still a beautiful sight. So now I'm talking Comedy Night, and it's Podcasted Right.
Welcome back to yet another Comedy Night Podcasted Right. I'm Riverside High star quarterback Matt Cale, and tonight we're talking about Thursday, October 22nd, 2009, and looking into the four latest episodes of Community, Parks and Recreation, The Office, and 30 Rock. Will the Dean be able to get Jeff to get Troy to play for the Greendale Human Beings? Will Leslie learn how to slash her way through bureaucratic red tape and get the pit filled in? Will Pam end up traumatized for life after learning about what Michael did while she was away on her honeymoon? Will Liz ever get Tracy out of her apartment? Yes, 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 and yes. Today, we will be discussing Community Season 1, Episode 6, Football, Feminism, and You. Parks and Recreation Season 2, Episode 6, Kaboom. The Office Season 6, Episode 7, The Lover. And 30 Rock Season 4, Episode 2, Into the Crevasse. I'm excited to be starting to pick up a little bit of steam. I think I'm mostly just being listened to by my wife at this point. But someone in France has downloaded both episodes so far. Bonjour, mon ami. Envoyez-moi un message. Je peux parler un petit peu français. I swear I was completely bilingual when I graduated high school. I'm assuming you understand English if you've been listening so far. And I want to hear from you. I spent way too much time before episode 1 came out working on the musical breaks between the segments, and I did them all after I was done recording the first show, which is why I never actually talked about them through that show. My main inspiration was seeing how often Community changed up their theme, depending on the theme of the episode. So I wanted to try to take my podcast theme song and mash it up with each show's individual songs. I kind of ran out of steam by the time I got to 30 Rock. That's like a full orchestra. There's a lot of instruments going on in that one. It's going to take me a while to get that one fixed. So you're stuck with them for a little bit. I'll pick away at them and see if I can sneak in some updated recordings as the months go by. I've really had an interest in writing and recording music for years, but never could really write anything beyond a few lines or just a riff here and there. So maybe I'll have a future in writing jingles for podcasts. I also realized way too late in my editing process that I forgot to make an intro for Review the Reviews, so you have that to look forward to at the end of this episode. Again, I appreciate that you're sticking with me, you hypothetical person who has found this podcast years in the future. This is a pure passion project for me, and I'm working very hard each week to make every little thing about the show better every time. So enough with the preamble, let's do this thing, and let's talk about what was happening on October 22nd, 2009.
This is the Comedy Night Podcasted Right Olds. If it was new, we call it news, but it's old, so we call it olds.
What was going on? Well, there's a few stories in the news. Microsoft launched Windows 7, replacing Windows Vista. I quite literally forgot that Vista was a thing until I read this news story. I only had the vaguest memories that Vista was constantly being made fun of at the time. I can remember my housemate in college getting a new laptop with Vista, and that I, being superior, knew she had made a poor choice. Well, I continued to use my laptop running Windows XP, which I had to send back to Dell every 4 or 5 months because they had to keep replacing my hard drive. But Vista? Gross. Windows 7 ultimately had a much better shelf life, with Microsoft only officially ending support in 2020. I realize you probably didn't tune in for operating system related content, But here's where we're at. To the majority of us, it's all the same. I took one computer science class in university, so just like Britta, I can claim to be an expert in that field. One day, the professor was discussing Moore's Law, which is essentially where we're improving transistors at such a fast rate that roughly every 2 years, you could double the computing power in any given, you know, microchip. And he was drawing comparison to things like, say, operating systems, where we had huge changes all the way up into the 90s. Then Windows 95 came along, and everything, to the end user, works kind of the same way in all the new systems ever since. Then the smart kid in the front of the class starts up with the, well, actually, and gave like a minute-long answer to all the stuff that was going on under the surface and in the programming. And the prof just looked at him and replied, yeah, but normal people don't care about that kind of stuff.
What kind of teacher talks to a student like that?
In other olds, and this one hit a little bit closer to home to me.
Literally?
On October 22nd, 2009, the Olympic flame for the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics was lit on Mount Olympus, Greece. It's this like really weird ceremony involving ceremonial virgins. Basically, they reflect the sun's rays using a parabolic mirror to light the torch. So here's the strange intersection of events. One, the Olympics in the US are aired on NBC. So as we get into February, we'll start seeing more and more mention of the Vancouver Games. I'll loop back to this when we get to February, because the final stretch of that torch relay had its own challenges. I came really close to seeing the flame myself. Typical torch relays involve the flame passing through Greece for a couple days, and they put it in this secure lantern thing, fly to whatever country is the host. So it showed up in Vancouver, then they brought it through the Arctic, then it swung back down and around through Atlantic Canada. It came to my town in November. The city had just built this big brand new stadium, and they held this huge event there. It was like a 5-minute drive from my apartment, but I was working night shift that night and couldn't go. I mentioned back in the trailer episode how weird of a time 2009 was for my life, and I think I attached my emotional state onto these shows that I was watching. I can remember back further when Vancouver won the Olympic bid. I was 17, and I was convinced by the time 2010 rolled around, nothing would stop me from going to see these games in person. But here we are, the flame had come and gone, one that symbolizes indomitable will, and I was stuck at home watching TV. But I do love finding these weird coincidences. And you know what's really strange? If all goes according to plan, I'm releasing this episode on March 25th, 2021, the exact day the Tokyo Olympic flame relay is expected to resume after it was suspended a year ago because of COVID.
Wow, you just wrinkled my brain, man.
So today in the olds, we've been talking about clinging to old flames. And we've also talked about moving past an uncomfortable former version of yourself to just improve into something better. I wonder if this will all tie into the themes of today's shows. Yeah, Will, I'm going to shoehorn it all in. It's going to tie up real nice.
This is what everyone watched instead.
Let's run down the viewership numbers on NBC, which, to no shock, finished dead last again. So Community had 5 million viewers, Parks and Recreation had 4.9 million viewers. These numbers are slightly up from last week, but in a huge positive here, the very next day, Community and Parks and Recreation both got picked up for the entire season. So rather than just knowing they were going to air episodes through the fall, they were going to get to continue all the way through to the spring. The Office came in at 8.7 million viewers, and 30 Rock with 6.8 million, which is up from last week, so some good signs there. And how did Jay Leno do? He brought in 5.4 million viewers at 10 p.m. Jay Leno's guest tonight was Hilary Swank. But thankfully, Jay's bringing on guests with connections to our other four shows and giving me something to talk about. Prince Family Paper, back in season 5, when Michael and Dwight go to a family-owned paper store. Remember how the B-plot to that episode is that the rest of the entire cast of The Office is debating whether or not Hilary Swank is hot? Forget the 2021 lens, this was a weird episode when it aired. I found an article from 2019 where Hilary Swank was asked what she thought about a 10-year old episode of television, and she couldn't have cared less. Someone in that writer's room had to be obsessed with her. Let's not talk about Kevin's comments about Boys Don't Cry, but her other award-winning performance, Million Dollar Baby, which was referenced in season 4's Money.
I just want what's best for you, Manushka.
Makushla, he's watching Million Dollar Baby. He's gonna try to kill me.
What else was on? So let's start with Fox. It's October, so that means postseason baseball. Specifically, this was Game 5 of the American League Championship, and it was watched by 11.9 million viewers. The New York Yankees were up 3-1 against the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, because naming rights can be hard sometime. If the Yankees win, the series over, and they'd move on to the World Series, while the Angels would have to win the next 3 games in a row. This had only happened something like 10 times in the entire history of baseball at this point. Coincidentally, it had happened to the Yankees themselves 5 years earlier, except they were up 3-0, and it was the Red Sox who rallied back to win the series, and Boston went on to win the World Series as well. Although the Red Sox won those games with the help of Johnny Damon, and he's now playing for the Yankees, so better shot. And this was the Yankees' first shot at the pennant since that loss in 2004. The Angels are the home team, and they're parking Anaheim, which is a totally different city than Los Angeles. And the Angels got out to an early lead, and it looked like the Yankees were rallying back in the 7th, but the Angels responded quick. So heading into the top of the 9th, the Angels were up 7-6. But the Yankees managed to load the bases. If they could win this game, there'd be a trophy presentation, so the trophy is all shined up and ready to go. And there'd be a champagne celebration in the clubhouse, so the champagne's all on ice. Then Nick Swisher pop flies out, and the Angels win the game. The Yankees ultimately won the series in Game 6 at home. Maybe this is one of those, we wanted to win at home anyways kind of things. The World Series was on next Thursday, so we'll talk more about that in the next episode. Meanwhile, over on CBS, Survivor was the only thing on that was new. 12.9 million viewers watched, as for the second time this season, a player was eliminated due to medical reasons. After several days of rain, Russell Swan blacked out during a reward competition and was not allowed to continue. Ultimately, there'd be no tribal council since Russell had been evacuated. On CSI, Grissom attends a lecture of famed professor Dr. Raymond Langston, who teaches about serial killers. I was super confused when I read about this, thinking, isn't Lawrence Fishburne already on this show? He was. They were just playing a rerun rather than going up against the American League Championship Series, and they just picked Fishburne's debut episode to replay. Here's something. Are there specifically any professors in the real world who specialize in just serial killers? Is that like an actual job, or does that just exist in movies and television? This rerun crushed NBC with 10.1 million viewers. When it originally aired on December 11th of 2008, it ran up against The Office's Moroccan Christmas and 30 Rock's Christmas special, and it had 20.9 million viewers in its original run. At 10 o'clock, The Mentalist was also on repeats with the plot of an ex-mobster who was murdered in witness protection. I got a few things here. First of all, how sweet would it have been if this had aired on the same night as Mafia? Maybe Grotti was involved. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen it. The episode is even called Red Sauce.
Red sauce on the side. If the sauce does not come on the side, I will send it back.
I'm also only just realizing now that every episode of The Mentalist has either red or blood in its title, since the main antagonist is a serial killer named Red John. The cynical part of me wants to call this lame. But considering how much I love the fact that every Community episode is titled like a college course, I need to get over myself. 11.8 million people watched this rerun. It had 17.1 million viewers when it originally aired 6 months earlier, April 28th, 2009. And something that I didn't realize before was that The Mentalist was on Tuesdays in Season 1, and only now, here in Season 2, it was put on Thursdays at 10, presumably to destroy Jay Leno. ABC, meanwhile, came out to play with some new episodes. Flash Forward came in at 9.9 million viewers at 8 o'clock, which was good enough for third place. IMDb summarizes the plot as, Mark must testify before a Senate Intelligence Committee about his flash forward. And I wonder if Mark runs into Devin Banks and Jack Donaghy while he's in Washington. Also, I missed mentioning this last week, but John Cho was a part of the main cast of Flash Forward, and we'll see him next season in 30 Rock's Double-Edged Sword. Grey's Anatomy won the night with 15.1 million viewers turning in. It looks like the plot is told with a lot of flashbacks, but after a burn victim dies in the midst of a chaotic ER, all the residents find themselves defending their actions to the hospital's board to avoid getting fired.
The last paper company you worked for burned to the ground, and all because they wouldn't hire a manager who lived and breathed paper. That's a travesty.
Private Practice, at 10, had 9.9 million viewers. Again, only good enough for third versus baseball and Mentalist reruns. With the doctors getting involved with the homeless teen and her young son, and there was money troubles, and honestly, the episode recaps I read for this show make no damn sense. Would everyone just be happy if I use this time for out-of-context Dr. Spichemin drops?
What can you do? Medicine's not a science.
What else was going on? Well, again, another classic It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia aired over on FX at 10, with a whole 1.6 million viewers watching the World Series defense. We learn about Riot Punch, Charlie brings back the Green Man. It'll be 2 months from this very day that two Vancouver Canucks fans, inspired by Always Sunny, show up to a Canucks game dressed in green lycra suits. Yes, that same Vancouver that those torches are moving towards. I mentioned last week how much I love seeing actors and actresses show up on different series, sometimes even when it's only a few weeks apart. Patricia Belcher plays the judge in this episode of Always Sunny. She's got over 150 credits on IMDb. You've definitely seen her elsewhere. But she was also in the pilot episode of Community a few weeks earlier. I watched all the pilots to prep myself for this podcast. I even made a test episode comparing them to one another. Maybe someday I'll release it as bonus content. Maybe I'll redo it properly. I don't know yet. It was basically just a test of how much research do I need to do? How do I sound on the mic? And holy shit, I lick my lips a lot and that's going to need a lot of editing. Anyways, I'm watching these shows on DVD, and on the DVD, the Community pilot is around 25 minutes long. Netflix, Prime, reruns, they all feature the syndication cut, which is your standard 21 minutes. If you've ever gone looking for, "You Wrinkle My Brain, Man," it's only on that extended cut. Or you can find that full scene on YouTube. Another scene that was cut out was Jeff joking to a cafeteria worker after he tricks Britta into joining the Spanish study group. And that worker was played by Patricia Belcher. What I can't figure out is, was that full cut the one that actually aired when it premiered? Or was it just the cut-down syndication version? I'd like to think it was the full version, and that I fondly remember seeing Patricia pop up twice on two different shows in a couple of weeks. And finally, the last thing I want to mention this week, which I normally would have ignored, but it does have some relevance. On Comedy Central at 9, The Jeff Dunham Show premiered with 5.3 million viewers. We're going to be seeing more Jeff Dunham real soon, so brace yourself. So that's what we watched and said, but I'm running pretty long, so I think it's time to hit the music and get to Community.
For we caught up colds and streaming was years away. We only binge on old DVDs and last one day. Stop going in my seat, it was still a beautiful sight. Now I'm talking comedy now, and it's podcasting right.
Football, Feminism, and You was directed once again by Joe Russo, same as last week. He hasn't gotten super famous yet. This episode was written by Hillary Winston, which is the first of her 7 writing credits on the show. And if the internet is to be believed, you can see her combing her hair in the bathroom right as her writing her credit appears on the screen. I only mentioned it at the very end of the last episode, but apparently these early Community episodes aired out of order. The production codes don't make a whole lot of sense either. It's possible they were written in one order and then filmed in another. And in fact, if you remember the end of season 4, no spoilers, but they very obviously filmed episodes out of order. Sometimes they filmed them even concurrently. I'm pretty sure there's an episode of the Darkest Timeline podcast where someone in the cast mentions that they never knew what episode they were filming on any given day. So they like to mix things up. So in this episode, we see Abed calling out the will-they-won't-they nature of Jeff and Britta's relationship, and then says,
well, that's sort of my gimmick, but we did lean on that pretty hard last week. I can lay low for an episode.
Abed really just disappears, much like how Shirley wasn't used at all last week. So Community is still having some trouble engaging all of their characters in one episode. This line also would have fit in pretty nicely after introduction to the film, where Abed makes the entire student film for his father, and Jeff and Britta's sexual tension has started to wind down over the last few weeks, so it makes this comment feel really out of place. All in all, there are minor continuity issues throughout this whole episode. Let's just hand wave it all away and say that someone rolled the dice on the first day of school, and these episodes are all from multiple timelines, and they just merged mid-season one, fixed everything. So the dean officially makes his first appearance in Study Room F, a trope that will set off many plot lines for many, many episodes for the remainder of the series. Multiverse shenanigans aside, he only seems to recognize Troy. The dean, in yet another attempt to make Greendale a real school, sees a golden opportunity, since Troy was the star quarterback at Riverside High, and he only lost his scholarships to other colleges when he broke both of his arms doing a cake flip, but he's now recovered. So, the dean finds Troy in a study group.
Well, look at this group having some kind of meeting and being so diverse. There is just, boy, there is just one of every kind of you, isn't there?
While the dean starts laying the seeds for Troy to join the football team, he mentions that Greendale is changing its mascot away from the Grizzlies, which is offensive since most of the student body has been called animals their whole lives, to the human beings. And that sets off Pierce on a mission to volunteer to design the new mascot. Annie has been enjoying the new Troy, the Troy that hasn't been focused on football, the Troy who is actually her friend. And with one will-they-won't-they fading away, we get a new coupling potential with Annie and Troy. The last thing Annie wants is for Troy to turn back into the douchebag he had been in high school. We come to realize that Annie's had a torch burning for Troy since school, not a literal Olympic-style torch, you know, the turn-of-phrase kind of torch. We get to see Britta's character evolving in this episode. At the start of the series, it seems like she's going to be the manic pixie dream girl archetype, a really cool, fun character that might just help loosen Jeff up. But thankfully, she's moving away from object of fixation into an actual person. Not necessarily that that new characterization is flattering, but now we see more of the Britta we will come to know. The Britta that fights the power, although she's often misguided in her attempts. Initially, she refuses to conform to the expectation that women need to travel to the bathroom in herds. But even Jeff realizes this is a cultural faux pas.
Girls go in groups. Did you learn nothing from stand-up comedy in the 90s?
At the next convenient opportunity, Britta invites Shirley to the bathroom, but being completely tone-deaf, she condescends everything about Shirley. We end up getting some great bonding between the pair here, as they lay themselves out completely. Shirley reprimands Britta, telling her that they can like what they like, but they need to be allies, and the bathroom is a place of solidarity. Britta opens up that, because of her nature, she's never been able to keep many female friends. We've been seeing a lot of emotional growth out of Britta these last 2 weeks, and while this may be not so much growth, but rather removing some layers from her shell, she's admitted vulnerability to Jeff last week and to Shirley now, and they've both reciprocated. We know that Britta eventually turns herself into a verb as the show goes on, and it's a characterization I've always felt was a little forced. But now, watching it slowly unfold, it is changing my perspective. Britta's always been a bit of a screw-up, but wrapped herself up in activism and turned that into her personality. As it's chipped away at Greendale, we start to see a little bit more of what her true nature really is. Because, as we'll continue to see, Greendale just loves destroying its students. We're also beginning to see how devious the dean can be. And it all starts when Jeff finds a Greendale poster with his face on it. He finds the dean working with Pierce on the perfectly neutral human being model. The dean wants to be diverse, but not specific.
Oh, that is our human color wheel. It goes from seal to seal's teeth.
What do you think?
I think not being racist is the new racism.
Quite honestly, it's probably a bad idea that the dean's only help here is Pierce. So we get to the core of what the dean is working on. Somehow, he's figured out why Jeff is actually at Greendale. He claims that he stumbled into this plan, but it's pretty calculated. He's correctly figured out that, one, Jeff does not want his legal colleagues knowing he's back in college, earning a degree, and two, Troy trusts and respects Jeff enough that he'll play football if Jeff can talk him into it. So blackmail it is. Jeff takes Troy to the Thunderdome and bemoans being stuck on the outside of the legal world. But Troy has a chance to create his own kingdom here on the field at Greendale. Their whole debate here, and I'm just going to play it, is a moment that lives on forever in memes.
I'm saying you're a football player. It's in your blood.
That's racist.
Your soul.
That's racist.
Your eyes.
That's gay.
That's homophobic.
That's black.
That's racist.
Jeff's persuasion skills are on full display as he convinces Troy, or should I say T-Bone, that he needs to go back to playing football.
How did you know my nickname was T-Bone?
Because you're a football player and your name begins with T.
Your name begins with T.
Troy immediately regresses and Annie calls him out.
Why are you doing our politically conservative high school's shamefully outdated fight rap?
Which... these things are awful, but they're so damn catchy. Honestly, every time I hear Al Gore, I think of...
Oh, bing, bong, sing along. Your team's Al Gore because your views are wrong.
Annie melts down. She had been working so hard to make Troy a better person, and Jeff has ruined him. Jeff, though, has doubled down with the dean, and those posters are only going to stop if Troy makes an appearance at the pep rally tonight. Annie threatens to blow up Jeff's plan with Troy, but Jeff goes mutually assured destruction and threatens Annie with telling Troy that Annie is in love with him. This obviously upsets Annie, and she goes colliding into the Shirley Britta story, with Britta actually being able to give Annie sound advice that she can't control Troy. And then we get Shirley coming in for a hug, not to comfort Annie, but to congratulate Britta on comforting Annie. Annie's made Jeff realize he's gone too far. He owns up what he did to Troy, but Troy doesn't care. He loves football. He just didn't want it to be his entire life, which is why he faked the accident. Everyone here is coming up with pearls of wisdom, and I really enjoy Troy telling Jeff,
I don't know about you, but I know I ended up here because things weren't that great out there. You should try accepting where you're at, man. Take a pottery class or something.
Really, that's the theme of this entire series. Greendale's not great, but you can make the most out of it because the world isn't great. It's almost like if you're stuck in a crevasse, maybe you should try digging down instead of back up. Okay, wait, we're not talking about 30 Rock yet. Well, we'll get back to that crevasse idea. So this leads Jeff to reconcile with Annie. He thinks they both made mistakes, which Annie doesn't buy.
Because I'm an 18-year-old girl and you made me cry in public.
Jeff pledges he's going to enjoy this experience more and he's going to make a fresh start at Greendale. It's almost like the old Jeff was Windows Vista, but now here comes Windows 7 Jeff. It looks the same, but works way better. And then we meet the human being. The terrifying mashup with no racial identifier. Now, Abed's been laying low the entire episode. And he appeared once in the cafeteria and he shows up at the tag at the end. But, like, that's Danny Pudi in that costume, right? Like, I'm not saying it's Abed was the human being. I'm saying Danny Pudi plays the Greendale student who plays the human being. I am positive they never show up on screen at the same time. Side note, around 2 years after this aired, my city got a pro basketball team. Professional in the loosest sense of the term, but it was real enough. Their mascot was
literally
just a dude with a gray Lycra suit. And unlike the Vancouver Green Men, this basketball team never owned up to stealing their idea from a TV show. So all in all, there's a little less humor in this episode, but a lot of world building at Greendale. This is one of Troy's first opportunities to shine, and he's such a lovable dope. There's some more growing pains here, certainly, but this show is beginning to flesh itself out, even more so than just the gray, neutral flesh of that creepy Greendale human being. So, before we get into the next three episodes, Community is actually the odd show out here, and maybe this does settle the debate that these episodes aired completely out of sequence. In my research, I discovered there was a promotional program happening this week across all networks. The Entertainment Industry Foundation had created a program called I Participate to to highlight the importance of volunteerism and being an active part of your community. No pun intended. Over 100 television shows that aired this week featured volunteerism in some way. Except, apparently, Community. I've watched this episode twice, and other than Pierce volunteering to take part in the mild hate crime that is the human being, there's no volunteering here. So I think someone didn't get the memo. But it will become a common theme in the next three episodes. And this leads into this week's Parks and Recreation, which really used the concept to full effect. Kaboom was directed by Charles McDougall. This was the first of two parks that he directed. He also directed 8 episodes of The Office, and he's won an Emmy for directing Desperate Housewives. This episode was written by Ayesha Mahar, and she'll have 14 writing credits altogether on Parks and Recreation. We've also got some great guest stars doing crossover here. Paul Scheer plays Keefe, the organizer of Kaboom. We've seen Paul before on 30 Rock, where he played Donnie, Kenneth's rival page. And checking my calendar, we'll see a lot more of Paul on next week's podcast when I get to start talking about The League. We also get an appearance from John Benjamin, who surprisingly didn't show up on any of these other shows. You'd recognize John as the voice of Bob from Bob's Burgers and Archer from Archer. Archer, coincidentally, premiered a few weeks back on the same night that Community premiered. However, the rest of the first season didn't start airing until January, so I'm sure I'll be bringing Archer up quite a bit more in future episodes. Meanwhile, the other lawyer in this episode, Chris Tallman, is played by Wendell Adams, who will show up in Community Season 4, Conventions of Space and Time. So, let's get down to the plot. First, the cold open again shows we're just off step with The Office by a week, with a credit card company checking in on some suspicious activity on Leslie's credit card. However, instead of honeymoons in Puerto Rico, Leslie has been buying all sorts of embarrassing stuff. And much like Abed shuffling off, never to be seen again, we don't get much else out of Tom in this episode, after he's reacting to all of Leslie's purchases.
What does the man pillow look like?
Daniel Craig. It's for my lower back.
And April's still in Venezuela. I thought Donna was still in Venezuela too, but she is in the background of a few scenes. But no lines, so no real appearances from either of them this episode. As I already mentioned, volunteering helps drive the plot of this week's episode. The Parks Department employees are volunteering in Eagleton, which, if you're a fan of the show, is something you know they'd never do. But, you know, let's just stop nitpicking on early continuity errors. Kaboom has come to Eagleton. It's a program that shows up in towns and builds a playground in a day. Paul Scheer's Keefe has so much positivity that he makes Leslie look like Ron. Forget fundraising or building permits or how safe a playground built in one day would actually be. Just kaboom it. Kaboom actually is a real organization. Apparently they actually do weeks of planning. It's just the construction that will happen in one day. And we finally get Andy back after he was... Okay, well, they don't explain where he was last week. He leads us to believe that he's moved out of the pit and he's living with his drummer. Realistically, I guess, he was probably in the pit the whole time last week. And since Leslie never took those delegates to the pit, I guess that's why we never saw Andy. But he's here now, and he's got some great advice on the key to volunteering.
A lot of pockets for putting all the food in. The Red Cross has amazing cookies. I go there all the time.
Kabooming has left Leslie super pumped up, and it's enough to relight the fire under her ass to get the pit filled in. She made a promise to Anne, and she needs to get this done. Back in Pawnee, Leslie is looking to kaboom the whole pit plan herself. She tries to kaboom her whiteboard, but Jerry's used permanent marker. Again. Who gives her real advice? Mark Brandanowitz. So, we never really got a chance to talk about Mark last week, since he barely played into the plot. But Brandanowitz is supposed to be an asshole. At least that's how he was originally conceived and why Paul Schneider signed up for the role. But time and time again, he is the only character who gives Leslie any sound advice on how to accomplish her goal. and he gives her the advice that I choose to live my entire life by.
Don't ask for permission. Ask for forgiveness.
Oh, I like that. Okay, wow. So who gives me the go-ahead to not ask for permission?
No,
is it wrong?
No, it's nobody. It's nobody. It's you.
So Leslie goes out and rents a guy. Or, more specifically, a guy with a backhoe.
I've never rented a guy before. Wish I knew about that during prom.
There was a girl at my prom who was known as the backhoe, Mary Dunbar. She'd let anyone massage her back.
Her plan very quickly backfires when the first load is dumped into the pit and Andy's living under a tarp. We catch up to Andy at the hospital. Keeping with tonight's theme of burning torches, Andy's figurative torch is still burning for Anne, and he can't get over her. He unhooks his heart rate monitor because it was annoying. Anne says it's not a toy.
Anything is a toy if you play with it.
Andy's misconstruing Anne's kindness as his nurse as the flame rekindling. Andy refuses to admit to living in the pit, and it becomes obvious that he can't get over Anne. So Anne ultimately has to switch Andy to a new nurse. We get our small bit of Ron for tonight.
What the c*** were you thinking?
I would prefer that she ask me for my permission so I can say no. I like saying no. It lowers their enthusiasm.
I think I keep forgetting how low-key Ron was through much of the early run of this show. Other than meeting Duke Silver a few weeks ago, he hasn't had much of a story, and instead, he's just a plot device. And Leslie is starting to realize just how much asking for forgiveness she'll now be doing. So Leslie shows up to the hospital to apologize to Andy, but the city's legal counsel, John Benjamin Scott Braddock, is there, and he gives her a list of every single thing she can't say or imply, since Andy currently has the power to sue Pawnee due to Leslie's actions. We get Leslie walking on eggshells, not being able to say what she actually wants, and we think it's all ridiculous until it turns out that Andy has indeed hired a lawyer to sue Pawnee, which actually seems pretty far outside of Andy's capabilities. Leslie realizes she has to get in touch with Andy without the lawyers present to pitch her case, and after several voicemails,
"Hey, free guitars at City Hall, everybody run!"
None of these work, so Anne takes one for the team, calls Andy up, tells him they need to talk at her house. Andy shows up buck-ass naked. I've seen Chris Pratt talk about this in interviews, and apparently, after several takes of wearing flesh-colored underwear, Chris decided to just answer the door naked. He jokes about it, but like, that's sexual harassment, brother. NBC actually gave him a written warning about protocol. I know The Office has probably destroyed all of her sense of how real businesses are ran, but getting written up is pretty serious. You get fired for any reason, and they have this kind of stuff on record, good luck fighting it. But I guess there were no consequences, because Amy Poehler's reaction to seeing Chris Pratt's penis is the shot that makes it into the episode. So again, NBC is doing the right thing here. Knowing what kind of character Andy becomes, this is kind of a painful episode to watch. Andy's funny and charming and goofy, but his pining over Anne is too much. They really couldn't figure out the right tone to set with Andy. But Leslie and Andy figure out a plan to make it right for everybody. Andy meets with Leslie and Scott Braddock, and Andy agrees to not sue the city if they fill in the pit. And he also wants to be the starting inside linebacker for the Colts. There's a great callback joke here where Andy's wearing the same travel pillow as a neck brace that Leslie wore after she fell into the pit. But then it turns out that one of his other conditions is that he gets to sit on the job site and watch the pit get filled in. Basically so he could just watch Anne all day. I can't tell how clueless Leslie is in all of this.
Who knows why that gopher does what he does.
Andy gave up $100,000 just to watch Anne. These are red flags, nope. But the plot takes a big leap forward here, where the pit is now a lot. You can think of the pit as being Windows Vista, and the lot being Windows 7. I will squeeze every last drop out of this metaphor. We're one step closer to Leslie finally getting a park built, with what she believes to be the hard part out of the way. So she calls up Kaboom to see when they can come build a park in Pawnee. What has to be one of the most absurd twists in Park's entire run, Kaboom is all part of an elaborate prank, and we see Keith boat off into the sunset. So for another week, we don't see too much from the rest of the cast here. We've really just got interactions between Leslie, Anne, and Andy working here. Objectively, it's a pretty funny episode, but just hard to look back at what the show would become and to watch it right after a Community, which, other than leaving one character out, can write a story that involves every character throughout. Parks is still relying on Leslie to do all the heavy lifting here, and most of the secondary characters just come in for punchlines. If I haven't said it yet, most of these characters become versions of the actor as the show progresses. Andy's always been a lazy douche, but Chris Pratt's goofy charm has always shone through. This feels like the writing just hasn't caught up yet to the performance, but we will get there. So at the very least, Andy did what he did for love. And love will continue to be a theme as we move on to The Office. The Lover was written by Lee Eisenberg and Gene Stupinski. They appear to do everything as a tandem. They wrote 15 episodes together. They also had directed Michael Scott Paper Company. They even act together, popping up here and there as Vance Refrigeration employees, Leo and Gino. So Jim and Pam are back from their honeymoon to Puerto Rico. And just like the turn of phrase, the honeymoon is over. Pam can't even get Aaron to put out candy without Michael's permission, which leads to Aaron awkwardly asking Michael for permission right in front of Pam, and then Michael doubling down on the joke by telling Aaron,
"Sure, thanks for asking."
We're really seeing how different Aaron's character will be at reception compared to Pam, and I think they've passed the torch nicely. Get it? More torch references. This is fun. We also get to meet Michael's newest character, Blind Guy McSqueezy. There's such a little gem that Michael says while giving the talking head in his office.
How do I describe it? It is a character I've been workshopping whose lack of vision gets him into all sorts of trouble.
Lack of vision is just such a pure Michael moment of doublespeak. After last week pumped the brakes on moving the season's story ahead, we have two major plots that begin to play out. First of all, Michael absolutely cannot wait to tell Jim that he has started dating Pam's mom. He's just chomping at that bit. Poor Toby walks in at the worst moment.
Hey, Jim.
Not now, Toby, my God.
Jesus.
Get the hell out of here, idiot.
What did I do?
So Jim can pretty much see how this is all going to unfold immediately and tells Michael to break it off. However, as we've seen time and time again, Pam is really the artist when it comes to wrangling Michael. That candy scene earlier was a great indication of how Pam kind of used to run the show with Michael without him even realizing. Jim's solution is just to try to keep them far apart and hope for the best. Running alongside all of this is Dwight's latest scheme to overthrow Jim, and that is to bug Jim's office with a wooden mallard.
I inserted a listening device into the belly of the mallard. Now I can observe Jim, trap Jim, and destroy Jim, just like in the Bavarian fairy tale. Only this time, the mallard skins the toad alive. And of course, in this version, you lose the whole veiled critique of the Kaiser thing.
Jim promptly finds the bug in the mallard. However, there's not much he can do about it because Pam wants to give Michael his souvenir. In an incredible acting display, the truth comes out. Jim and Michael's discomfort, Pam's slow realization, it is all amazing.
Who is it? Who is it, Michael? Ooh.
It's okay.
No. No. Oh my God! Oh my God! No!
That could have gone one of two ways, but I never expected her to get upset.
But the way the rest of the episode plays out, it all seems really weird until the very end. But let's just put a pin in that for a minute. Michael's only relief is to get the chills from Dwight. And I gotta wonder, how often do they do this to each other?
There's an egg on your head and the yolk is running down. The yolk is running down. There's a knife in your back and the blood is gushing down.
Sleeping with Pam's mom, sometimes dinner.
Blood is gushing down, the blood is gushing down.
Jim has no idea how to deal with Pam. So he turns to his only outlet, pranking Dwight. And he starts with bringing Andy into his office, playing an opera so loud that Dwight can't hear anything, and getting Andy into a conversation that he can't tell Dwight about. He then also re-gifts the duck,
Mallard,
to Kelly, so Dwight is forced to listen to Ryan and Kelly talk about fedoras. We get to the conference room, and Michael is giving a presentation about volunteerism. Unlike Parks, this is really just awkwardly shoehorned into a scene, where we learn that Dunder Mifflin has apparently given Peruvians cancer. Dunder Mifflin is falling apart at the seams, people. Pam's already so mad at Michael that she derails the entire meeting, and Jim is just trying to hold things together. But Pam's mom calls Michael during the meeting, and this causes all hell to break loose. Again, it's so weird to see Pam so openly hating Michael. She's usually his defender. They have developed this bond over the seasons that it seems like Pam is just being needlessly cruel here. Michael almost actually makes a good point here, asking the entire office,
"What is so wrong about me? I'm caring. I'm generous. I'm sensual. Is it really so horrible that I could possibly go out and find happiness?"
Michael knows how to sell, and he's won the office's support over to his side. With Pam still on the offense, Michael's best idea is to get Toby to do his dirty work for him. I honestly didn't know which way this was going at first. The buildup kind of made it seem like Michael was sending Toby after Pam to punish her, especially with his look to the camera when he hugs Toby. But ultimately, it's less nefarious. Michael's just looking for anyone else to fight his battles, and Toby proves to be useless. Michael just throws Jim right under the bus and pleads with Pam that he just wants everyone to be happy. He'd do anything for Pam to make her happy, but Pam can't let this go. So Michael, defeated, tells her,
"You know what, I'm going to start dating her even harder."
What's that supposed to mean?
You know what it means.
Jim finally calls out Dwight for the spying. Dwight begs for mercy, and Jim realizes he can swing this in his favor and gets Dwight to wash Pam's car. You know, like a normal place would fire you for bugging your boss's office, but instead, you just have to wash a car. The last time Dwight staged a coup, all he had to do was some laundry. Kind of like Chris Pratt exposing himself, there is no real consequences here. Jim brings Pam to the window and shows her Dwight at work, saying that Dwight did it because he knew Pam was having a rough day. "Jim, stop lying to your wife." Pam has a moment of self-reflection, asking if she's been overreacting. And me, us, all of us, the audience members, have been thinking, yes. But Jim snaps us all back to reality with, "Nope, you're not." Because blind guy Mesqueezy is dating Pam's mom. And, in our final twist,
"Of course I wanted Jim to find the Mallard, make him feel safe. Did you really think I would put my primary listening device in a wooden Mallard? I'm not insane."
If it's anything like editing a podcast, he'll get sick of this pretty quickly.
"I've got 8 hours of this."
But it's never resolved in this episode if Jim actually knows about the second bug or not. We end up with a pretty fine episode here. Another pretty low-key episode, even more so than last week's, with no guest stars. We don't even leave the office, other than a few scenes in the parking lot. But we are moving along the story arcs here. Things are pretty rocky right now, with all this animosity growing between the characters. And interestingly enough, no one is backing down from their position. They're all choosing to dig in their heels and dig even deeper. I love it when the themes line up because this leads us into the crevasse. Hit the music. Into the Crevasse, written by Robert Carlock, who wrote 26 episodes of 30 Rock, and he went on to co-create Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt with Tina Fey. This episode was directed by Beth McCarthy Miller. She's directed 23 30 Rocks, 3 Parks and Recreations, 1 Community, but unfortunately no offices. She got her start working on MTV, notably directing their Unplugged concerts. My music tastes are firmly rooted in the 90s. So Nirvana's MTV Unplugged means a lot to me. But perhaps more relevant to the general population is that she eventually got into directing Super Bowl halftime shows, including the infamous 2004 show, which destroyed Janet Jackson's career, did absolutely nothing bad to Justin Timberlake whatsoever. As for crossovers and guest stars, John Glazer would have a small role here as Mike with a name tag at the bookstore. Beyond the time frame of this podcast, John would have a recurring guest role starting in season 5 on Parks and Recreation as city councilman Jeremy Jam.
You just got jammed.
Dinesh is played by Alok Mehta, who will go on to appear in 2 episodes of Outsource. I haven't brought up Outsource yet, but it's looming out there in the future. I haven't decided yet how much I'm going to talk about Outsource when the time comes, but just tuck away that knowledge. And finally, Will Arnett appears for the 5th time as Devin Banks. I'm shocked that this is only his 5th appearance, because he felt like such a big part of early 30 Rock seasons. Will Arnett was, at this time, married to Amy Poehler, and he'll actually show up on Parks and Rec in a few weeks. He also briefly cameos next season on The Office and Search Committee. Will Arnett was actually nominated for an Emmy for this guest appearance. So let's get to the story. Liz's Deal Breakers book, which was the hot story coming out of season 3 and was completely skipped in last week's premiere, is now out in bookstores. She's starting to gain plenty of negative attention from all the men whose wives have read the book and are now giving them shit. Mike from the bookstore is a deal breaker. Frank's a deal breaker. Lutz is a deal breaker. Pete's a deal breaker. Zubas, in his first of many appearances, is a deal breaker. And Tracy Jordan's a deal breaker. Tracy's wife, Angie, has never been more mad at him, and he set his sight on punishing Liz for what she's done. Jack Donaghy, meanwhile, has gotten a phone call from the head of GE, Don Geis, that he's needed in Washington, D.C. So I understand very little about the economy or American politics, so I'm going to try my best to contextualize this. Forgive me if I'm slightly inaccurate, just try and hit the broad strokes here. The auto industry was in really rough shape at this time. And in late 2008, near the end of his second term, Bush approved a $17.4 billion bailout to Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler to help stabilize the industry. Chrysler and GM would both declare bankruptcy anyways within the next 6 months. And lots of people lost their jobs. The executives all made out like bandits. So Obama, who according to Jack,
is Kenyan and smokes cigarettes,
is starting task forces for other industries, including microwaves and small appliances. Jack is determined that GE won't be compared to those greedy buffoons in Detroit and believes this is all just a formality and they will not be taking any government bailouts. Microwaves may not be as popular as they were in the 50s when surf rock bands were writing pop songs about them, but they're doing just fine. Liz, meanwhile, just wants Jack to find the retainer she lost at the Air and Space Museum during a junior high field trip. Liz bumps into Kenneth, who, in a blink and you'll have missed it moment, was actually doing the microwave a few minutes earlier in Jack's flashback from the 50s. Kenneth, you ageless wizard. Kenneth asks to work only 20 hours today so he can go volunteering. If we're grading the shows on how they worked volunteering into the plots, Parks gets an A, I'll give 30 Rock a B+, The Office only gets a D- for sure, and Community gets a did not complete the assignment. Kenneth is volunteering at an animal shelter, rather than his usual gig volunteering at Big Brother.
It's an organization that secretly watches people and makes sure they're behaving properly.
I could honestly just play clip after clip of everything Kenneth says at the shelter, because everything is gold. I myself completely lost it at
the donkey died. You're the donkey now, Kenneth.
But ultimately, this is all a plot device so that Kenneth will end up adopting all the dogs, probably because Dwight is going to show up this weekend to euthanize them. Jax in D.C., meeting with the task force.
Bum, bum, bum.
Devin Banks has weaseled his way into the government task force. Banks has all the inside dirt on how GE is wasting shareholder money, because it was he himself who wasted all the money in the first place when he worked for GE. Banks follows Jack back to New York and reveals this was all a long con to get back at Jack for getting him fired. He had to worm his way into the Obama's inner circle by becoming friends with Molly and Sasha. Banks is going to tank all of GE just to take down Jack.
Think of the pensions, the employees, the kittens we use to test microwave strength.
Banks is going to leak Jack's testimony, leaving Jack with no other alternative but to find a way for GE to sell a lot of microwaves very quickly. Angie's anger has escalated into kicking Tracy out of the house. So, in the quest for punishment, Tracy shows up at Liz's apartment and moves in, claiming it's all her fault in the first place. It doesn't take long for Trey to take over the phone answering duties and...
It's Jenna, from work.
Jenna's gone to Iceland to film a sexy teenage werewolf movie in her continued efforts to lash out about TGS getting a new cast member. She reveals that they have to film at night, but Iceland only gets 1 minute of darkness a day, and she's doing everything she can to delay shooting as much as possible. Tracy, meanwhile, has brought a literal elephant into the room to talk about the figurative elephant in the room. Many of Liz's deal breakers are directly stolen from things Tracy has done, and now Tracy is determined to make Liz even more miserable. This leads to the payoff from Kenneth's plotline. Liz comes home to find Tracy has filled her apartment with shelter dogs. Jack has turned to the TGS writers to come up with an idea to make GE microwaves profitable again. And, completely unlike those buffoons in Detroit, Jack is convinced the American public will want giant, unreliable, four-doored microwaves on wheels. Jack's so hung up on fixing the company, he can't spend time to mediate Liz and Tracy's problem, so he makes a quick decision that Tracy will get Liz's life rights, since Liz clearly stole from Tracy's life for her own book. We then get to the title of the episode, where Jack teaches us the lesson that sometimes, when stuck in a crevasse, sometimes you need to climb deeper in to work your way back out. You gotta climb down into the darkness. You gotta call your fixed operating system a whole different thing to convince people to buy it. Everyone's in their own crevasse now. Jack and the writers have spent days inadvertently redesigning the microwave into a Pontiac Aztec. Tracy's running up Liz's cable bill by buying porn. And Jenna's gotten mercury poisoning from rectal thermometers. So, some of these crevasses are literal. Devin Banks is back to rub it in Jack's face one last time. Jack's out of options, and without being able to come up with a new idea for microwaves, he begins his climb down, telling Banks that he should have just forced Jack to take the bailout. A government bailout would have meant that Banks, as task force overseer, would be Jack's new boss. Jack would be miserable, and Banks would get to boss him around.
I'm honestly not trying to make this sound gay.
No one is, it's just happening.
Banks takes the bait, and Jack may be defeated, but at least GE hasn't been destroyed and they live to fight another day. Liz climbs down too by giving Tracy the idea to turn her life rights into an adult film, which Liz is going to write. Liz apologizes to Jenna via porno dialogue, and finally, tying up the biggest loose thread in this entire episode, Jack found Liz's retainer.
Now my dad won't be mad at me.
So we get another tightly packed episode of 30 Rock this week. This is a show that won't hold your hand to explain what's going on, especially everything that's going on with Jack. I spent an embarrassing amount of time on Wikipedia trying to understand the 2009 auto industry bailouts just to really figure out what was happening. But all of that aside, it is packed with jokes. Politics have always been a part of 30 Rock, so now we're seeing the shift with how Jack is handling life as an executive in the Obama administration and how he's handling the growing public displeasure with large corporations. The writers have finally remembered that Liz wrote a book, so that's being woven back in. The looming threat of a new cast member shaking up TGS is still being teased. Probably the hardest part in dissecting this episode is just how topical it was. Government bailouts, the obsession over Obama's daughters, and the then recent craze of sexy teen horror movies. Twilight New Moon hadn't even come out yet. That movie had sexy werewolves, right? And that was Into the Crevasse. We've hit rock bottom, so let's just keep digging down. And now that I got a new song and everything, let's review the reviews.
Review.
Football Feminism and You scored a B- from the AV Club. There's numerous references here where they too point out that this episode aired out of order, and it would have helped to contextualize a lot of things that have happened, like fleshing out the Dean or explaining Annie's relationship with Troy. The general feeling is that this is a good narrative story, but not as funny as the earlier episodes, which I agree with. Definitely not as many quotable moments, but it's funny. They started to point out how this show is more about the entire cast rather than just Jeff, and they're starting to pick up that Annie may actually be the better foil for Jeff than Britta. The big miss here, though, is that they say that Troy is never going to be the show's funniest character. Although I suppose it does take a while, but you should never say never. IGN only scored the show a 6.5. They draw a really interesting parallel between Community and My Name is Earl, with both being stories of the main character looking for redemption. But this is early on, and it felt like Community was already starting to fall flat. Some of this I think is a little warranted. Shirley and Britta's storyline felt like it was going to be more self-aware, especially with Jeff joking about it early on. But instead of it being laugh-out-loud hilarious, they tell some more subtle jokes and build the character relationships. They also bemoan Jeff not really being the main character despite having top billing. Is that really so important? The review says the show isn't clicking, but I disagree. And that's not the future lens either. By this point, I know I was telling people about this show. And there's a really telling line in this review that will show you why you end up seeing things in these old episodes that leads to them getting removed from streaming services nowadays. Everything that happens in the Dean's office is ironically offensive. And this review says that they disliked the final reveal of the gray human being since it wasn't bold or silly or ironically offensive enough. Surprisingly, I think Community makes a pretty ahead-of-the-time jokes here, because you'd expect that ironic offensiveness, since that's what so many shows were doing at the time. Instead, we get silly. Maybe it's not silly enough, but at least there was enough foresight that the human being is a joke that they can continue to use again and again, realizing that less is more, and you've been ironically offensive enough already. The AV Club gave Kaboom an A, possibly built on the strength of how good the show was becoming. Not willing to just hand out A's, it had been a question of what Parks would have to do to finally break through that glass ceiling. And I guess a nude Andy Dwyer was enough to do it. They do point out that this episode was leaning less on Leslie and more on the ensemble, but I still feel this was a pretty Leslie-centric episode. Anne and Andy get some moments here, and it's an improvement since last week, but there's not much else going on here without Leslie. Anne, Andy, and Leslie do not an ensemble make. We need the whole cast back and in this show. IGN scored the episode an 8. IGN is a bit better at describing the plight of Andy than I was, probably because they're professionals, but also they don't know what happens next to Andy. At this point, Andy is a pretty complicated character. They could have just kept him being a lowlife, which is clearly what he started out as. IGN points out that you just can't help but feel sympathy for Andy, even despite his actions. Maybe some of his actions didn't seem as problematic back then as they do now. But then again, IGN's not one to really care about being problematic. They also call out that we get some down-to-earth moments between Leslie and Anne that help reinforce why they are friends, since Anne is so put together and Leslie is such a doofus. But considering how Anne seems to be impressed by Andy's grandiose gesture, maybe Anne is just a sucker for dummies with big hearts. AV Club gave The Lover an A-. The reviewer apparently had a similar story of a coworker wanting to date his sister, so I guess it rung true. I guess I can't relate here. Pun fully intended. One thing this review picked up on that I haven't been able to convey fully here through the audio medium, but this is an episode where so much of the humor comes from the reaction shots the characters are making. Jim, while he's originally hearing the news from Michael, Pam's reaction, Michael giving that cat that ate the canary look. These are all called out specifically in the review. There's so much more. Creed listening to the aria. Dwight listening to his bugs, everything with Aaron and the candy. This is a highly visual episode when it comes to joke telling, which I guess is unfortunate for Blind Guy McSqueezy. IGN scored this episode an 8.7, despite it being uneven. But uneven is probably an unfair term. Dwight and Jim feuding over the bug, Toby trying to counsel Pam, these are all good scenes. But it comes down to Jenna Fischer, John Krasinski, and Steve Carell in the initial reveal scene that IGN called Emmy-worthy in one of the best-acted scenes in the series to date. Hyperbole aside, it's hard to disagree. And really, everything with Michael and Pam in this episode is a complete roller coaster, in a good sense of raw emotion. I don't really think back to The Lover all that often. It's typically not one I think back as being an all-time great episode, and that's probably because the rest of the episode just can't hold up to how good those scenes are. Maybe it's all a little too horrifying to score it higher. Maybe because The Office is at its best when Michael is being the worst. And despite not broaching it in the best way possible, I think Michael's complaint back to The Office about why am I so terrible changes the tone away just a bit from pure comedy and puts it more into a character development style episode. The starkest contrast in reviews comes with Into the Crevasse. And I think so much of these reviews at the time are based on the episode's relevance to just the show itself. AV Club gave it a C+, the lowest score of the night. According to them, 30 Rock was faltering compared to earlier seasons. There were signs that the characters were just morphing into broad characterizations of themselves, the Flanderization effect, if you will. Jenna's desperation is becoming one note. Tracy moving in with Liz is the old sitcom trope, and while they seemingly go for the satirical, but it's not satire just because it thinks it is. But ultimately, their review is that this lightning-quick show was starting to slow down. Completely the opposite, IGN gave Into the Crevasse a perfect 10 out of 10. Now, granted, I'm waiting to see what IGN considers to be a mediocre episode of 30 Rock. But the first line of their review states, how am I going to write about that? Which, true, yeah, I felt the same way. Ultimately, after going through one pass of watching the episode and trying to tie it together, I felt exactly the same way. In complete contrast to the AV Club, the feeling here is that the show is seeming to double down on how many jokes it could pack in. And the thing that 30 Rock does is that all of the jokes are hilarious. But I think, and here's my hot take, that it's almost too much. There's a plot to this episode, and it's a pretty straightforward one. But there's just so many jokes happening that you actually can't process the story fast enough. I don't know. Maybe I'm just stupid, and that's fine. But I feel the fact that these reviewers can't process it in real time shows that I'm not the only one. The opinion I'm beginning to form about 30 Rock is that it's a relic in the sense that it can't be consumed in a binge. I was watching 3 to 4 episodes a day last fall when I was rewatching the series. And when I got to this point, I couldn't tell what was going on anymore. Everything just happened so fast, you need some time to process it and think about it. I think I might even be missing out by not having commercial breaks just to air my brain out a little bit. Robert Carlock and Tina Fey brought this same style of humor to Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which, by the nature of its release, was designed for binging. But when you watch a new season of that show in a 3 to 4 hour stretch, your brain just can't absorb it anymore. Or at least mine can't. And maybe that's how you end up with these divided reviews. At some point, maybe, with every single line becoming a joke, you grow numb and only the biggest of laughs seems like a joke. So what are my final thoughts? Overall, this is a much stronger week than last week, for sure. Everyone was going into the crevasse tonight. The study group at Greendale has learned that maybe they need to step off their high horses and just be who they are, where they are, and that will give them a shot at happiness. Leslie realizes that sometimes you can't wait for the government to do the right thing, on time, and you need to take matters into your own hands. Michael didn't mean to fall in love with Pam's mom, but now that he has, he's just going to have to force Pam to accept it for what it is. Liz and Jack let their adversaries get the win, just to get a moment of rest for the rest of the battles to come. And Microsoft realized that as long as every other operating system they release works right, nobody will even remember how bad Vista was 15 years from now. You can find videos of the Olympic flame being lit for the Vancouver Games on YouTube. It's a little awkward to watch. Seemingly nothing happens for a while. An unlit torch is stuck in the metal bowl, and you have to sit there and wait for it to light. It takes more than a minute and a half, which is actually kind of impressive for ancient technology. And it's a bright sunny day, so you're squinting, thinking, is that all that happens? But no, not yet. The torchbearer is patient. She makes these small adjustments, getting the torch to the perfect spot where the sun's rays converge, and then seemingly, when you think the whole thing is a bust, the entire bowl is lit up with a flame. And that flame continued to burn for months. Community is still awkwardly positioning itself. It takes some time, but these characters are developing dimensions, and they're in a bizarre setting that's going to start sparking greatness out of them. Parks and Recreation is igniting. We believe in Leslie, and even though her quest seems silly at first, it's just a park. But even if it's small in scale, her steadfast devotion is showing us how important these things can be, and that is the fuel that will keep the story going. 30 Rock is burning bright. In fact, it can be a little hard to stare directly at it sometimes because it's so intense. And The Office is the flame that continues to burn long after it's been lit. It's come so far, yet it's still warm and inviting and comfortable. And like these stupid deep metaphors aside, these shows can still just make me laugh after all these years. The acting, the writing, the direction, the production, everything is so well done that even when I'm dissecting these shows and trying to weave them all together, I sometimes just catch myself sitting on the couch, absorbed into the story and laughing along. Well, it's been fun. I'll be back in 2 weeks. We're nearing the end of October, so expect some Halloween-related shenanigans. We have Community's Introduction to Statistics, Parks and Recreation's Greg Pakaitis, The Office's Koi Pond, and 30 Rock's Stone Mountain. If you want to get in touch with me, whether it's feedback on the show, ideas about future content, telling me how I'm too hard on your favorite show, or that you don't give a crap about the other ones, reach out to me at comedynightpodcastedright@gmail.com. If you've got an idea for the future, try to reach out early, because now that I've got the ball rolling, I want to try to get a few episodes recorded and saved up. Or, I don't know, if you're listening to this months or years from now, I still want to hear from you. I'm also active on Twitter, @ComedyNightPod1, and on Instagram, @ComedyNightPodcastedRight. I still don't understand the nuances of social media. I have so many Instagram followers and no Twitter followers. Is that normal? Again, hopefully once I get more episodes recorded and in the bank, I'll have a bit more time to engage on those platforms. But you can always reach out to me through them as well. I want to thank you for listening. I said this a few weeks ago. I've been wanting to try out podcasting for a long time, and I'm just so excited I found an idea with enough content to build a show around. I was worried when I got started that I still wouldn't have anything to talk about, but now I'm having trouble keeping the show down to a reasonable length of time. This has been Comedy Night Podcasted Right, hosted, recorded, written, produced, edited, researched, all of it by me, Matt Kale. I wrote all the music you hear, including my lovely tone-deaf singing voice. I also do all the artwork and social media for the show. You'd be surprised how long it takes to find the right screenshot, capture it, edit it, turn it into a GIF if it's going on Twitter, and gathering all those audio drops too. Man, I didn't think I'd be putting so many of those in, but they take forever to capture as well. Listen, you know what? I'm not complaining, because this actually isn't a podcast.
It's an elaborate prank. For my next prank, I'm going to build a hospital in a poor part of China. He'll never see it coming.